हरिः ॐ सहनावतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यङ्करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहैः ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ जय श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिव सरिगौर भक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
Okay, page 128. Okay, Sri Sukadeva Goswami continued. Thereafter, to save the people from the danger of an unregulated government, the sages churned Maharaj Nimi's material body, from which, as a result, a son was born. Srila Prabhupada comments, Arajakam Bhayam. The government is unsteady and unregulated. There is danger of fear for the people. At the present moment, this danger always exists because of government by the people. Here we can see that the great sages got a son from Nimi's material body to guide the citizens properly. For such guidance is the duty of a Kshatriya king. A Kshatriya is one who saves the citizens from being injured. In the so-called people's government, there is no trained Kshatriya king. As soon as someone strong accumulates votes, he becomes the minister or president, without training from the learned Brahmins, expert in the Shastras. Indeed, we see that in some countries the governments change from party to party, and therefore the men in charge of the government are more eager to protect their position than to see that the citizens are happy. Right? Means you have one party, depends upon what it is, then you have that, how you say, some you're voting for the president, that goes in, or the whatever it is, the head of the government, then they're in. The others, you're voting for a party, right? And then the party puts in their person. So now, if it's based on that, then you can change who's the leader of the country simply if the party changes. So if partway through the term, members of one party, especially if it's close, may switch to the other party, and then the other party becomes stronger, so then their man goes in. So as Prabhupada points out, it's more about just the party and the people and their positions rather than about the people. Because otherwise, for the people, if it's something stable and steady, that's better. But here, it just becomes pure political. It's just about how to be in power. Right? So another interesting point, because Prabhupada's pointed out, you know, the by the people one, is that you have people who are not trained in government. But they're the ones that are actually technically, you know, calling the shots on the government. So that's very interesting. Something like running a country, you would think that's, you know, needs some training, some skill, right? So little things. You want to work down at the store. Unless you have a degree and some skill, you can't get a job. But somehow or another, you can have the highest post in the country and have no skill at all. No training. And they'll be elected by people with no training. So Prabhupada's pointing out that this is not a strong policy. Right? In other words, people have to be trained. It's one thing is you have a party. The party then is trained. The party trains people. And then they present that here is our candidate. This is the person that we say he's trained. He's going to be good. Then maybe you have some. Then people pick between two persons that are good and they prefer this. So that's another thing. But there's no training. It's not about training. Like that. Yes?
It would seem that the proclivity now in most society, and also you see that in the devotional circle as well, is that if you're a good orator, then you have the place. But if you're not a good orator, then there's no place for you. So what is that? Is that just...
No, it means you have the cheaters and cheated aspect. That people like to be cheated, but they like to be cheated nicely. You want to be cheated so you don't know you're being cheated. You know, it's just like let's say, in the morning or something, and then some member of the family comes up, very, very cheery, very, very nice, oh, Dad, this and that, you know how much you love us, like this and that, and you kind of know something's going to happen, but you don't mind because it's being presented so nicely. So that's the thing. And also, it sounds good to the intelligent sense, the material, another aspect, we take it on a bigger principle. One is that as long as we see we're getting some benefit, some recognition in this and that, we don't mind. So you see, generally those who are better orators, then they make who they're talking to feel good. The other aspect is in the material world, everything is speculation. There is no absolute. It's not connected to the Lord. It's like a boat without a rudder. So therefore, if someone makes something that sounds nice to the mind or intelligence, or even better if they can do it to both, then that's the best of the speculation, so therefore you'll consider it superior. Like that. Does that make sense? So, and, because of that modern thing, you have to get out there, who can show. So someone who can make that public show, then people are more confident. It's like the, what do you call it? Sometimes it's used in, the grand gesture. It can't be just something there. It has to be in front of everybody. And then, okay, then he really means it. So if he can orate in front of so many people, then it works really good. Is that something?
Then, a particular party doesn't have a majority of votes, then it has a friend party, and then we have the two friend parties coming together, and the cabinet of ministers is being formed by
yes.
two parties together. So is this particular concept Vedic? Did we have any time in the...
No. Vedic means when you have the higher court and you have the lower court. The higher court is the king and who he appoints. Like that. And they're the ones that actually make the decisions on the country. So that means the king's trained, the ministers are trained, they're all working under Brahmins who they, are superior to them. So then people who are trained, who have the proper knowledge and all that, then that's the thing. The lower court means that within a village, then you have what's called a panchayat. And it's supposed to be representative of everybody there, from your Brahmins and your different occupations and everything, so that the village is represented, right? Mm-hmm. And that's their local government, mm-hmm. right? So amongst themselves they talk, and then they, everybody's represented, so it has that very much based on representation, right? So that is, okay, this is what people feel, this is what they want, but they're not, they just do day-to-day and they're all there together, so they work it out, right? Then from amongst them, one person represents, right? So then they go up into the next group, which is 10 villages, 10 representatives, right? So there's 10 representatives. They oversee 10 villages, right? Then from amongst them, they have a head. They're in the next level up, which is 10, how you say, from 100 villages. Right? Then you have up to 1,000 villages, however many it takes that you get up to the government level when the whole country's been covered. Mm-hmm. So all those representatives, they represent the country democratically. You understand? That's the lower court. So you have a higher court and you have a lower court.
So there needs to be a hierarchy like this.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So the whole point is they're all representing the people nominated by. But then, as we see, it's the first is just who's qualified within that. But then within that is those who are qualified, they're choosing the next one. So there is some qualification. And then as they go up, the qualification's higher, so their choice is better. You understand? They represent what's going on in the country. Okay, there's a drought over here, people are suffering and this and that. So then that goes to they present that to the higher court, and the higher court then decides, okay, then we'll take the king's granary, we'll send it over there, and then, we'll increase taxes, and in other areas that it's good, like this. So what will be done is decided by the higher court. But the representation is there in the lower court. You have a similar kind of thing where you have the parliament supposed to be representing the people and then who's on top. But if it's the same party, it's not really any different like that. But if you have where the top is one thing and then you have the that representation there, right? You know. So, in other words, they're all using a kind of something like the Vedic, but not quite. You know, it's like they'll use the thing where the lower house is actually the one in charge rather than the higher, like they have the, what do you call it? Parliamentary monarchy, or what do they call it?
Republic.
No, no.
Respublica.
No, no, no.
Like it's the aristocratic model. Like Lokshabha, Rajshabha.
No, no. You didn't catch the name. The Queen of England, what do you call the government?
Monarchy.
No, that's a monarchy. But it's, she's still there. She's still the queen.
She's the head of state.
Yes, but it's run by the parliament. There's a name for that. Okay, nobody knows.
I think it's like you said.
It's like the parliamentary monarchy or something like that. But the parliament's the one that actually runs things and makes a decision. The nobility is simply figureheads. But in the Vedic, they both have their position. Not that it's one and not the other. Because we'll take, oh, so the king just decides no one else is there, or everybody else decides the king's not. But the Vedic is both have to be there. That makes sense. So they're using some semblance here and there. In other words, there's always the concept of a government. That's Vedic. Right? Somebody in the government's making decisions. That's Vedic. You know, that there may be some representation of the people. That's Vedic. But how they put it together and the training of the individuals and what they base this on, that will be the problem in the non-Vedic. Right? Yes.
So we see in the Bhagavatam, the government is connected to the people, but it's independent.
Yes.
But nowadays, it's completely disconnected and also dependent on the votes.
Yes.
So this is.
Yeah. Then it gets even weirder as you go.
Yeah.
So that's the whole thing. Is just the when you're dealing with the modes of nature, then the one thing you have to appreciate the modes of nature for is how weird they can get. Because we think it's okay, there's you know, you have the three modes, but then 3 times 3 is 9, times 9 is 81, times 81, and it just keeps going till you end up with 8,400,000, right? So when you calculate this, you'll also have in the multiplication the combinations, there's going to be ones that are the same. Because you start from one side and start from the, you end up with the same thing. So dropping all those, the ones that are individual, that's the ones, if you keep multiplying, you'll get to 8,400,000. Because otherwise, if you just multiply like that, you either end up, you end up at 12, like 12 million, or I forget what's the number below that, you know. But it's never, because there's so many that are the same, like that. So that's how many combinations she can get. Right? And they all run. You know, you have a group of animals, they all have their government. Like I think it was Burijan Prabhu was telling me about horses. You know, a horse stands straight looking at you. That means they are, what do you call it? You can approach. But if they turn sideways and don't look at you, that means you can't approach. So whoever's the head of the herd, then, depending on they chastise or discipline members of the herd, or the by that method, when they'll just turn, they won't talk to, they won't deal with them, and then they, you know, everybody then's like that, so they're on the outside, and then when the head person will deal with them. And so he was showing me once, we were out where some horses were, you know, and there's the fence, and the horses generally come over. So he would stand like this, and they start walking. When he turned sideways, they would just stop right where they were. And then he'd turn again, and they'd start coming again. So it's just, that's...
How does he know?
I'm not sure how he knew, but he learned it from somewhere or like that. And he was probably reading something and thought, hey, you know, and he saw the horses, so he tried it out, and then he was showing me. And it's for us. So there's all these different ways, so that means there's that many options for running a government. So then there's what's recommended in the Vedas. This is human. So you can say it's no, but it's running here, it's efficient here, but efficient on what species of life? Right? That's the whole thing. So what the Vedic says, this is human. You can say, oh, we're being practical. But being practical what? Because we're not up to the level of practical termites or practical bees, you know, or practical ants that actually have good, you know. You know, so we're more like practical dogs or something. Yes.
So in ISKCON, we don't have an acharya, which would be easier when Prabhupada was there, that was everything was very clear.
Yes.
But now we have a, you know, bit different system. So how does it function actually?
Means the system is given by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. Because you want to have, and that goes back to Rupa Goswami. So what he did is bring out the system that was given by Rupa Goswami and then, you say, formalized by Jiva Goswami. That's the Vishva Vaishnava Raja Sabha. So the Vishva Vaishnava Raja Sabha is the assembly of Vaishnavas in total. And then amongst that, then you'll always have someone who is the, you could say, like he'd use the word president, like that. And so he was saying in the Sampradaya, when we see the names that are there, because there's so many senior Vaishnavas and everything, and how the line's going down and all that, but that's the line of the presidents. Mm-hmm. So Rupa, Jiva, Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, then how is it? Narottam Das Thakur, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, then Baladev Jagannath, that like this. This is the line of the presidents of the Vishnu Vaishnava Raja Sabha. So then, how you say? So in that, he wanted that, because when you're dealing with these personalities, then, like you said, then they'll call the shots, it'll go. But the thing is if you want to expand it, then you have to work on the principle of how people can, how the devotees can understand what to do. So, seeing that Rupa Goswami and the Acharyas have already given what to do, you know, especially we see with Bhaktivinoda Thakur how to preach into the Western environment. And so Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur and Srila Prabhupada were bringing that into that, you know, just working with that, refining that. So then you're going to have a system in which that can carry on. So, since the structure has already been made, the principles are already in place, the standards are already in place that have been established by the Acharyas, then what you need is individuals to see that standard is going on. That's the most important thing. Because managers will manage, but that they're managing according to the set standards given by, you know, the Acharyas, then that's what's necessary. So that's the governing body commission. That was given by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. So he expected it to run like that. But this thing is that it went like that. And then some say it's after 2 years, some say it's after 8 years. Then because, you know, they have to discuss a lot and you actually have to get into some administration, then it was felt by the senior-most person that this is difficult. Why don't we just go back to having an acharya? Then one guy says everybody does. And because he was the senior most preacher, then they all accepted it, disbanded the GBC, and made one person the acharya. And it's been downhill ever since. Mm-hmm. So it just didn't work because they didn't follow Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's order to function by a GBC. So then, Srila Prabhupada, then he, you know, understanding that mood, took the preaching, and as soon as he had some devotees that were trained, immediately started the GBC. So I think it was started in the 60s. There was originally 12, and then in the 70s it went to 24, as the preaching expanded. So the idea was 24, they could take care of the whole world. You know, everybody has an area like that, and then you know, especially in those days it was more geographical. And so then it's very easy to run. So the GBC is to see that the standards that are set by Prabhupada and the Acharyas, that's followed by the actual administrators, which are the temple presidents. Temple presidents, project leaders, whatever is the, whatever you call them. Like that. That's what the GBC is for. So The managers will manage, but I mean, they're trained, they're solid devotees, so they'll know what to do. But to just see that higher understanding of Krishna consciousness there, that's what the GBC is for. So it's just like the king is running things, but he has ministers, which he does within his management. So Prabhupada wanted the president, the secretary, and the treasurer, that they would be, you know, the ones that would meet and control the temple. And then they'll have their department heads, you know, your head pujari, sankirtan leader, temple commander. They'll also give input. But then above that, then you would have senior men in the community, but above that, to see that it would go on properly, is the GBC. So the GBC, they're the highest managerial authority, but that doesn't mean that they're the ones managing the society. Just like we see with all the kings, it always mentions they work under the direction of Brahmins. But the administration is always with the king. So that means those Brahmins are the highest managerial authority, because they're the authority of the manager. But this wording is not understood. Basically, because these kind of approaches are being made by those who basically haven't really spent any time in India. And so they don't actually understand how the Vedic system works. But those who spent time in India, you see it everywhere. Every temple runs like that. Like let's say in the Gaudiya Math, you'd have the sannyasi, the senior preachers and all that, but then you had the temple, the mutt manager, who generally was a grihastha who ran the temple, dealt with all the administration, all the internal running and all that. But the standards by which it ran, that was the sannyasi and preachers. You know, the Madhwas, it's the same thing. The Ramanujas, same thing. Every temple in India is exactly the same. There's a sadhu, some senior, whatever they are. And then there's someone who actually just manages it day to day. It's just the standard thing. Every institution in India has that spiritual thing, ashrams or mutts or temples, that's how they're all run. But not having any experience in this, because the West, it's not. The king is the head of church, is the head of state, is the head of whatever he likes to be, and that. And so then that's all we're used to. So Manu is there, how humans are supposed to work. Basically, the modern, it's you have the Magna Carta and the International Bill of Rights to keep them from being animals. So we're not talking about humans, we're just talking about, more domesticated animals, like that. While the Vedic is, you're talking about human. So you don't have, means the Dharma already sets who does what, so that naturally restricts. But in the modernists, no, you have absolute authority, because otherwise Prabhupada said highest managerial authority. Now they're using the term ultimate. I don't know if that's to do with UFC or something like that, or where they're getting the ultimate from. But that's the new thing. Yeah. But that's the whole thing. But the point is, it's like Prabhupada's, so was that one devotee? He was saying, oh, Prabhupada, I'm the most fallen. And Prabhupada said, you're not the most anything. Like that. It's the acharyas, they're the most. The Goswamis, they're the most. So, therefore, is that if it's understood, then with what you have, what Prabhupada's given, what Bhaktisiddhanta says, it's very easy. In other words, using the Vedic is actually the easiest, because then everybody does what they do. So, your senior most devotees, they're senior most because of their Krishna consciousness. So then sing to the standards of Krishna consciousness, that's the easiest for them to do. And people who are managers, administrators, then to do that, that's the easiest for them to do. But then when you have those who are good at being, devoted sadhus, trying to manage, and then those who are managing can't manage because they're being managed by those who don't know management, then you end up with the worst possible system that you could ever speculate on. Even gross materialists would not come up with such a thing, because it's totally impractical. So that's the difficulty, is that all these things, that's why it keeps saying, you have to have governments, its purpose is to protect the people. like that. That means what that means the strategy is protecting the people. Then you're going to have your methods to protect. Like that. But you'll see is that if we're, like you said, using, you know, in our model, in the strategy, it has nothing to do with protecting the people. It's not part of the strategy is, okay, what are we going to do? But that's down on the lower levels. In fact, it's down on the lowest level. But they'll call that strategy. And so that means then what's mechanical, technical, then will be the strategy. Then what's mechanical, that'll be the operational. And then below that, in that system, there isn't something below that, but we've created something. It's called below that, which we would say instead of the technical, it's called micromanagement. So in other words, we have the technical, the mechanical, and micromanagerial. And nobody uses that system, especially those who created the system, you know, the Western system. So it's sad. But, and so to organize that would be very, very difficult because it's unnatural. It's like trying to push a boulder uphill. And so then you need so much to do. But if you're only having to push the boulder downhill, you know, how much do you need? Yeah, so it's very, very easy. So that's the whole point, is that whoever's there on that GBC level, they could very easily be good GBCs. But to say, to interpret that ultimate managerial authority means that they're actually the managers that call the shots on the managerial decisions, then basically there's no chance of them establishing that, because then they would all have to be administrators to do it. And except for like two or three, none of them are. So there's no question of being successful in that. It means you can talk about it, it sounds great, they come up with newer and newer plans, but that's what Prabhupada talks about. More and more speculation, more and more, but if you base it on the scripture, on what Prabhupada says, he always says that he was such a good leader, a king, because he followed the Brahmins. Right? He was very, very clear about that. Because already this point of ultimate managerial authority was already tried back in the 70s by Tamal Krishna Maharaj. And Prabhupada made it very clear, he's not the ultimate authority. The temple president is. So if you want to go ultimate managerial authority, that's the temple president. And then he's got an authority, which is the GBC. So Prabhupada already made that very clear. But the point is because it's cultural, it's being approached by, you know, the, what do you call it, socio-economic, you know, on the level of pranamoy, so it can't be understood. Minimum, you have to approach it from dharma, from manamoy. Then only you can understand. But Prabhupada, you see, every administration where they're bringing out their abilities, it always mentions this point, always following the Brahmins. Right. And the bigger they are, that you tell more about them, the more this is mentioned. Like that. So that's the. If that's understood, it's super simple. It means the concept. It means to apply it, of course. Then there's all the work and everything and effort and stuff to do. But the concept is super simple. That's the way all the Vedic, all the concepts are super simple. If you understand what they mean. Like that. Like the other day I was reading Krishna book. That Prabhupada was talking about, who is it? I think it's the prayers of Devaki to Krishna after he's born. So then she's saying about how the senses and the elements, you know, and that are all go back into the, means you have the elements, so those go back into the, that is the sense and the sense objects. So that goes back into the Mahatattva. Then the Mahatattva goes back into the Avyakta. And the Avyakta goes back into Pradhan, that goes back into Krishna. But generally when we discuss it, we only discuss Pradhan and Mahatattva. Avyakta is not brought up so much. We only see it really discussed in that discussion with Vidura and Maitreya, where that the Lord glances And so the living entities, the ego is there, so there, and time, so there's a catalyst, so all the elements separate. But it's still, it's not Pradhan, because Pradhan is homogenous. It's separated, but it's unmanifest. It's a vyakta. That's then where the demigods, the primordial demigods, then they say to the Lord that we can't make anything because none of the elements will go together. So then the Lord enters. And then from that, he's the attractive feature. And then all the atoms can be put together and make the primary creation. So that's the difference between avyakta and the mahatattva. Mahatattva means all the elements of the primary creation are there. Pradhan is homogeneous, and avyakta then is separated but still not able to work. So it's actually very simple.
Is that akshara?
Avyakta.
But is that the same as you had mentioned in the Brahma Sutra? Akshara.
I'm not sure. You'd have to see when we get back to Brahma Sutras. You can find it. And then we can...
Antarama.
No, akshara would be generally in the Mahatattva. You're going there because akshara means if you're going by sound. Sound is being nod. That's the concept of everything. Because that's where everything comes from. Is that. Right, so in other words, it's just trying to show Krishna is everything. So that's one of the things that are everything. Because it'll be one of the things that the Supreme has talked about in relationship to. Right, before when we were discussing, that was in connection with Manamaya. So that's the Manamaya Purusha. So he's the Lord of the creation, so therefore the laws, he's the Lord of the laws. So he's the one that makes all the laws work. All the different positions, all the demigods, all the different species of life, all the planetary systems. So that's the thing. The Vedic is very simple, but it's very sophisticated. So the modern is very sophisticated, but very complicated. You know, so if you want to simplify, then it loses its sophistication. But the Vedic can maintain its sophistication and become very simple up to very, very, you know, complex. That's the advantage of it over all these other systems, because it's meant for humans. The other one may work very nice for some other species of life, but not for humans.
It's a constitutional monarchy.
Constitutional monarchy, okay, that's the point.
So, when you see that, is the effect of such improper government seen through the judiciary system? Because we see that there's always this constant involvement of law and what is actually seen as law. We even see that within ISKCON, they're always revising ISKCON law.
Yeah, well, probably makes that point. But it comes down to fear. So why is there fear? I won't get a position, someone else has a position, you know, all these different things like that. So the point is unless it's about protecting the people, then fear will be the basic element. So then there's always fear. So then the people, the general populace, they're fearful. Those in positions, they're fearful of losing their position. The others are fearful, you know, what will come next? How will I be controlled next? You know, the environment will be unsteady. So that's why in the Vedic, that's the one thing. There's not anything else. And we see going through now, we're up to here, we've gone through trillions of years of history, and it's always been the same thing, protecting the people. This never changed. It means if you want to deal with governments, there's no change. If you want to deal with you know, how you say, economics, then yes, making profit, that's your thing. So if we're taking it on, you know, what's economically viable and this and that, then we're not talking about governance. So...
At the time of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, was there a GVC before he left his world?
That I'm not sure. He just told them to run things by a GVC. So that was the advantage. Prabhupada could establish it much earlier. So as soon as he established it, they would run things. He would just see to the standards. They would take it that, no, he's managed it, but he wasn't. He was the president's, everybody else was that, and he would just say what's the standard, so he could say he changed things, but that's the point of the ultimate manager. It's about the standard. not about how you're going to affect it. Right? If in affecting it you go against the standard, then it has to change. But in affecting it, it doesn't go against the standard, then there's no problem. Then like that. So it's the standard. You know, it's just like the deity worship's going on and it's not clean, then it has to become clean. So that may change how they manage it, but it's based on this higher principle. So the ultimate principle is Krishna consciousness, pure devotion. Management techniques, that's a lower level. It's being taken that management techniques are the highest principle. But then we're saying karma produces bhakti. And that's not our philosophy at all. And even if you want to count it, it's the lowest level of our philosophy. You know, real, you know, neophyte after being enthusiastic and then when they go into the slump. Right? And then how to get out of the slump, then by management. Right? But actually to get out of the slump by war with Maya. Anything that's not pure devotion you throw out. Even this is dealt with in our philosophy. Right. So,
Can we have the temple president functioning not as a manager but as a Brahmin? And he's having, you know, let's say a group or a committee of 3 or 4 members who act as managers. And then the decision has been taken by...
But it's his call. The point is, the temple president, it's his call. If he wants to set it up that he has himself a board and they manage it and he just sees that they're doing, fine. But it's his responsibility. If it doesn't get done, it's his fault. Like I think one temple president was complaining about, you know, something wasn't done. Mr. Prabhupada, oh, that devotee didn't do it. That's why it didn't get done. Prabhupada says, no, it's your responsibility. If he doesn't do it, you have to do it. How many understand? That's management. So all the duties in the temple, let's say in the temple there's 20 duties, all those duties are the direct responsibility of the temple president. Now, if by his arrangements and management, he can get other people to take all those 20 duties and run them, and he just oversees that it's going nicely and facilitates, then that means he's a good manager. That's the meaning of, what is it, managing yourself out of... No. But the mean where you manage yourself out of having to manage. There's a term for that. You know what I'm saying? He's such a good manager that everybody else is doing anything and he has nothing to do. But what is his thing to do? He's fully responsible and he's seeing that everybody else is there and they have the facility to do because they don't see beyond their own area. See, that's the thing. It's the thought, no, I have to do it myself, or I sit back and, oh, it's their thing to do. So I delegate it, so now it's their responsibility. No, it's still yours. So if this is understood, this balance, then, yeah, if he wants to set it up and the other guys, that just means he's the better, that's lazy intelligent. Like that. So we see is, I think, of the two, you know, main trained managers of Prabhupada, Bhavananda Prabhu and Kamal Krishnamaraj. Then Tamal Krishnamaraj, he was lazy intelligent. While Bhavananda was active intelligent. Like that. Because he'd go around, see everything and all that. And but at the same time, he already delegated everything, but he would be right on top of it. While Tamal Krishnamaraj would sit there in his one place and have everybody coming and telling him what's going on. You know, and then if need be, he'd go out.
You know, very good friends, huh? Which is impossible now. You know, they were such a good friend.
Yeah, yeah. No, they
now
were.
It's impossible. If you do this and you do the opposite.
Yeah, no, they were the best friends. Okay. Does that make sense? So that's the whole point. That's the position of the president. It's his total responsibility. However he wants to organize it, fine. Like that. Because then you know, you have one more person on a daily basis seeing to the standards. So that's better, other than when the GBC comes and then he checks. So if he can get to that position, that would be ideal. Right? You understand? We're not saying that the temple president is a kshatriya, it's just that he has the responsibility in that area. Right? Just like the GBC, it's a brahminical responsibility. But it doesn't mean that by nature conditioning they're specifically Brahmins. They may be from any. You know what I'm saying? Like that. Like you see, some GBC, their area, you know, everything's going on nicely, but you see they're outstanding in collection. They have the most money. right? In other areas, then they're outstanding in administration. Other areas, then it'd be outstanding in, you know, their puja or their knowledge, things like that. So you see that there's different. But the point is it's still the standards Prabhupada set, and then within that, then they encourage. So the point is the position, the duties are brahminical, the duties are that of the kshatriya. But it's not that they themselves are categorized, oh, if you're temple president, you're a kshatriya. Does that make sense? Yeah.
If we go about this duties, usually you can perform your own duties according to your nature.
Yes.
That's the best.
Yes.
But if it's not your nature to give protection and everything, but you kind of ended up doing that.
But you have to know that that's what the duty is. But you have to know that just because, let's say, if someone's a Vaishya, it doesn't mean that he doesn't try to protect the devotees. That position, that's what he's supposed to do. You know, just like you may not be a cook, but there's no one there to cook the Rajbhog offering, you'll be cooking.
That's an emergency.
Yes, it's an emergency.
So it would be better for the temple president to have that specific nature that will help.
The point is how the temples are so simple. They're basically a place for deity worship and preaching. So you're just managing that. So like a head pujari manages the department, that doesn't make him a kshatriya. So technically, someone being of brahminical nature, they could run a temple, but also kshatriya, because it's about devotional service. So you're managing devotional service. We only mention it in this hierarchy because even though no one likes Varnashram, we like to use it as a, you know, who's in charge here. Like that, you know, so that's why it's not appreciated at all. If you create a bureaucracy, that's actually shudras. Bureaucracies are never leaders, they're never dwijas. They might be a dwija that's taking up that position, but that's the meaning of kayasta. Kayasta means a dwija is taking up a shudra job that needs brains, right? So that's why they can do it. Regular shudras can't do it, you need a kayasta to do it. Like that. So basically, they become kayasthas. But, you know, necessary. But then that means then they have to have leadership above them, and above that, then the brahminical. So then that puts them two cis down instead of, you know. So the higher up you try to go, you actually end up lower. That's the fun part. So. Okay. The Vedic civilization prefers monarchy. People like the government of Lord Ramachandra, the government of Maharaj Yudhishthira, and the governments of Maharaj Parikit, Maharaj Ambarish, and Maharaj Prahlad. There are many instances of excellent government under a monarch. Gradually, the democratic government is becoming unfit for the needs of the people, and therefore some parties are trying to elect a dictator. A dictatorship is the same as a monarchy, but without a trained leader. Right? So monarchy means they're trained, not just that it's a king, because if a king is just there, he's not trained, and just what he says is done, technically that's a dictatorship. So you could say the Western monarchies have all been dictatorships. That's why they didn't work very well. I mean, administratively, they go on, but as far as the people being happy. So when we say monarchy, it means someone who's trained properly in the Vedic principles. Okay. This one is who is sorry. Are they inside or outside? Because if they're in, they should go somewhere else to do the song. Okay. Actually, people would be happy when a trained leader, whether a monarch or a dictator, takes control of the government and rules the people according to the standard regulations of the authorized scriptures. So that's the point. If someone's a trained leader, then the people can be happy, whatever they are. It doesn't matter what system you're using. But if they're trained, it'll work. That's the whole point. So democratic means anybody could be the leader, but it should be anybody who's trained could be the leader. So if you want to be a leader, get trained. Then you can vie for position. So the point being made is, without training, someone can't run the government. Without being trained, one won't protect the people. If you don't protect the people, then there's actually no point of the government. That's the actual purpose of government. Just like eating, the purpose is nourishing the body. That's why junk food, though for sense gratification is great, but for nourishing the body doesn't really do anything.
So food has to be wholesome.
Don't get into this. Means we're bringing out, means in other words, don't take the example and then run with that. What we're trying to say is that people eat food, they want it to taste nice, but it also should be healthy. So if it's only healthy but not tasting nice, then it's still not quite right. Right? Does that make sense? So that's the whole thing, is we might have good management, but if it doesn't protect the people, it's actually missed the whole point of what governance is about. You know, just like it may taste great, but it's not nourishing, so it's missed the whole point. Yeah. Otherwise, then the Romans, they got it down, right? Yeah.
We actually see that, because even if you want to win a campaign in any of the modern political countries, you have to have a certain amount of money backing you up just to even make it into the cards to actually get voted in.
Yes. Yeah, that's why generally who has the most money wins. Yeah. That's why this last election, it didn't make sense. Like that. Yes.
Is there any examples in the Western world of
a trained leader?
Yeah, a trained leader.
Yes, there's one that I know of like that, but they don't know so much about him. His name was King Arthur. You know King Arthur?
Yeah,
so he was King Arthur, and he had that, you know, Knights of the Round Table as ministers. And so the people were happy, ministers was happy, he was happy. The only one that wasn't happy was his wife. And so it didn't work out so good. But, you know, so that means at least he was trained properly on the Varna side. Ashram side, he needed a bit of work. But, okay. Other than that, I'm not sure. Oh, no, there's one other. King David. Like that. He did well. Solomon also. Moses was good.
That's questionable. That's questionable. Not many survived, and you need to protect your people.
No, but he was good in administration. He would have become the pharaoh, but then he took up the religious. He wasn't as good as the others. Jacob seemed to be quite good at what he was doing.
I mean, that's Dwapara Yuga, that's not
fair. Yeah, that's the only problem. It goes back to previous yugas. So. Sorry. Okay, so here. So, actually, people will be happy when a trained leader, whether a monarch or a dictator, takes control of the government and rules the people according to the standard regulations of the authorized scriptures. So that's the thing. By ruling by authorized scriptures, that's then the principle. You're trained in these scriptures, you rule by the scriptures. Like that. That will work. Yeah, so then you can get, what do you call it? Of the scriptures, by the scriptures, for the people. Right? That would work. Like that. But the problem, if you start with of the people, then we have a problem already. Right? Unless, of course, you're into KFC, you know, how you say, chicken nuggets, then, you know, then you can get somewhere. Yeah. So you need a tub of that, a Harley, and hey. Okay. Verses 13 to 27. The dynasty of Maharaj Nimi. Sri Sukadev Goswami was a... I hope that wasn't too close to it. Hey, you're talking about my friends. Yeah, it means everybody in my whole county is like that. Okay. Because he was born in an unusual way. The son was called Janaka. And because he was born from the dead body of his father, he was known as Vaideha. Because he was born from the churning of his father's material body, he was known as Mithila. And because he constructed a city as King Mithila, the city was called Mithila. For King Parikit, from Mithila came a son named Udavasu. Mithila means that's where Jarasandha was, no? He was the king of Mithila. Later.
His dynasty was Magadha, but yeah, was it Mithila?
I think it was Mithila. So that's Patna. It's in Bihar.
Was it Magadha?
Huh?
Was it Magadha?
Magadha is the dynasty, but I think his city was Mithila.
Actually, Mithila is the border of Bihar and Nepal right now. So
a little farther north. Oh, okay.
Mostly everything is Bihar province.
Okay. 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 Oh, King Parikit, from Mithila came a son named Udavasu. From Udavasu, Nandivardhana. From Nandivardhana, Suketu. And from Suketu, Devarata. From Devarata came a son named Brihadrata. And from Brihadrata, a son named Mahavirya, who became the father of Sudriti. The son of Sudriti was known as Drishtaketu. And from Drishtaketu came Haryasva. From Haryasva came a son named Maru. The son of Maru was Pratipaka. And the son of Pratipaka was Kritarata. From Kritarata came Devamita. From Devamita, Vishruta. And from Vishruta, Mahadriti. From Mahadriti was born a son named Kirtirata. From Kirtirata was born Maharoma. From Maharoma came a son named Svarnaroma. And from Svarnaroma came Hrasvaroma. From Hrasvaroma came a son named Shiradvaj, also called Janaka. When Shiradvaj was plowing a field, Mithila. That's where Janak Maharaj is.
Yeah, that's
so that's more that's more the Nepal side.
Because that's Nepal, huh? Because Janakpur currently is in Nepal.
Yeah, but it must be that whole area. Okay, that's that side, not the. Okay, so then.
The birthplace of Sita is right now in Bihar.
Okay.
But the half part of Mithila is now in Nepal.
Nepal.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, Shiradvaj, also called Janaka. When Shiradvaj was plowing a field, from the front of his plow, Shira, appeared a daughter named Sita Devi, who later became the wife of Lord Ramachandra. Thus she was known as Shiradvaj. The son of Shiradvaj was Kushadvaj, and the son of Kushadvaj was King Dharmadvaj, who had two sons, namely Kritadvaj and Mitadvaj. O Maharaj Parikit, the son of Kritadvaj was Keshidvaj, and the son of Mitadvaj was Kandikya. The son of Kandadvaj was expert in spiritual knowledge, and the son of Mitadvaj was expert in Vedic ritualistic ceremonies. Kandikya fled in fear of Keshidvaj. Okay, son of Keshidvaj. And Kandia was the son. Okay. The son of Keshidvaj was Banuman, and the son of Banuman was Satyadyumna. The son of Satyadyumna was named Suchi. From Suchi, Sanadvaj was born. And from Sanadvaj came a son named Urjaketu. The son of Urjaketu was Aja, and the son of Aja was Pulujit. The son of Pudujit was Arishtanemi, and the son of Shrutayu, and his son was Shrutayu. Shrutayu begot a son named Suparshvaka, and Suparshvaka begot Chitrarata. The son of Chitrarata was Kshemadi, who became the king of Mithila. The son of Kshemadi was Samarta, and his son was Satyarata. The son of Satyarata was Upaguru, and the son of Upaguru was Upagupta, a partial expansion of the fire god. The son of Upagupta was Vasvananta. The son of Vasvananta was Yuyudha. The son of Yuyudha was Subhashana, and the son of Subhashana was Shruta. The son of Shruta was Jaya, from whom came Vijaya. The son of Vijaya was Rita. The son of Rita was Shunaka. The son of Shunaka was Vitahavya. The son of Vitahavya was Driti, and the son of Driti was Bahulasva. The son of Basulasva was Kriti, and his son was Mahavasi. My dear king, Parikit, all the kings of the dynasty of Mithila were completely in knowledge of their spiritual identity. Therefore, even though staying at home, they were liberated from the duality of material existence. So he sees that there's a Janak Maharaj, and all that, then there's always that line we can see is that they were always very spiritual. And we see that many, like I mentioned, they were very good at spiritual knowledge, the rituals, all these different things.
Lord Krishna goes to this Bahulashwar.
Down to Bahulashwa. Oh, okay, from there, another son. Okay. Srila Prabhupada comments to verse 27. The material world is called Daiva, or duality. The Chaitanya Charitamrita, Antya 4, 176, says, in the world of duality, that is to say, in the material world, so-called goodness and badness are both the same. Therefore, in this world, to distinguish between good and bad, happiness and distress, is meaningless, because they are both mental concoctions, manodharma. Because everything here is miserable and troublesome, to create an artificial situation and pretend it to be full of happiness is simply illusion. The liberated person, being above the influence of the three modes of material nature, is unaffected by such dualities in all circumstances. He remains Krishna conscious by tolerating so-called happiness and distress. This is also confirmed in Bhagavad Gita 2.1.2.14. O son of Kunti, the non-permanent appearance of happiness and distress and their disappearance in due course are like the appearance and disappearance of winter and summer seasons. They arise from sense perception, O Skyana Bharata, and one must learn to tolerate them without being disturbed. Those who are liberated, being on the transcendental platform of rendering service to the Lord, do not care about so-called happiness and distress. They know that these are like changing seasons, which are perceived by contact with the material body. Happiness and distress come and go. Therefore, a pundit, a learned man, is not concerned with them. As it is said, Gata shuna gata shumshana nu shochani pandita. Wow. Bhagavad Gita 2.11. The body is dead from the very beginning because it is a lump of matter, right? So the body is always dead. It's just that since the soul is there, it becomes animated and somehow it is maintained. But otherwise, the body is always dead. Like that.
Seems very alive.
Hmm?
Seems very alive.
Yeah, but that's only because the soul's there. That's the thing.
Zombie.
Huh? Yes, yes. And maybe that's why zombies are so popular. So everyone's a zombie, right? It has no feelings of happiness and distress. The body doesn't, right? It's the soul. Because the soul within the body is in the bodily concept of life, he suffers happiness and distress. So the body doesn't suffer. It's the soul that suffers. The body actually couldn't care. Right? You take a rock, you take a hammer, break it into pieces. Rock couldn't care less. So the thing is, it's the soul. So that's why I perceive that it's alive, because the soul is perceiving.
It's like the example of the car. If the car is hit,
everyone's
in the car doesn't feel. But if the driver is in the car, you feel that the car is being
hit. Yeah, and also get out, why did you hit me? Can't you see where you're going? You know. Like that. No, but you pulled out, you didn't signal, you know. Yeah, but why are you going so fast? You know, so you means this, the car is him, you know, like that. So you're, why are you going so fast? He's just sitting there, he's not moving at all, the car is moving. And the pulling out was the car, so yeah. Yes.
So we have a soul which is not affected on one side, and we have a dead matter which is a body. But then, because cars is a very far away example. Car, we don't feel, we feel mental pain, but it's not a physical pain.
Mm.
holistic body, we do feel physical pain when we can't, when something.
Because we identify with it. If we're absorbed in Krishna, then that might not be there. But if you're going to work through the body, then you see the condition of it, because it has the senses and all that, so you're connected with it. That's why, you know, like Pallad, they just absorb themselves, you know. So then they don't, they're not even conscious of the body. But if you're conscious of the body, yes, there'll be that feeling of connection. But the point is even that, it's just a matter of, okay, let us say the guy is a real adventurer and likes to go out there, right? So then he goes out to climb the mountain and it gets more difficult. So it becomes more enjoyable. You know, so that's the thing, is that that's why Prabhupada said before, this good and bad, happiness and stress, is meaningless. Because one will interpret this as bad, someone else will say it's great. So that's the whole difficulty. Is on the material platform, you can't identify what's actually good and what's not. So only in connection with Krishna consciousness, then you can define. The Shastras will say, as if this is the result you want, this is what you have to do. So if you want that, then getting that, then following that process, that will get you it. So that's considered pious. And then these are the goals that are normal for humans. So that's the standard. So you go for that, then that would be pious. But if you don't, you go for something else against that, then that will be considered sinful. But it's still just that it's defined that these, you want that. But the point is that for the soul, none of that has anything to do with it. So for the soul, going for Krishna consciousness, that's then the principle that actually is, that's sad-dharma. These others are dharmas, but they actually have no connection to the soul. It's not that the soul can't engage them, but the point is if they're not engaged on the platform of the soul, then that's why it says it's a waste of time, it's useless. Because those dharmas are simply, you know, you want to eat, this is the process. Like that. But why do you want to eat? That's generally not asked. So that's the point Krishna's pointing out, is that it has to be done in connection with Him. So what is of value to you, you have to see connected to Him. Otherwise, it's an illusion. Because we'll say, this is me, but it's not, because we're not the body. And the body, so if we're not the body, then the body doing all those things is even less me. Just like you said, the body's there, but the thing's connected. So the body, you could say, is more connected, but the car's not. And then driving the car to get some like this, so it starts to get farther and farther away.
Yeah.
So the dharmas are simply what are various kinds of goals that human beings could endeavor for within the human context, and still maintain their position as humans. You know, just like dogs, they don't climb trees like that. But cats do. Cat couldn't climb a tree, you'd think it's weird. Dog climbed a tree, you'd think it's weird. Especially if it was a big dog, you know, St. Bernard, you know. That would be strange. You know, and then leaning on the branch, you know, like that. You know.
It would become suspicious.
Yes, like that. And especially that they drool on you. That's really bad. That's why dogs don't climb trees. See, cats climb trees, they don't drool on you. But now if a dog climbed a tree, they drool on you. Therefore, since human life is about cleanliness, therefore, it's arranged dogs don't climb trees.
The cows don't fly.
Otherwise, you'd never get milk, right?
Milk, okay. Something else.
Oh, yeah, that would even... Yeah, that's true. That's a big point, yeah. Yes, so like that, it's arranged. That there's a dharma. But the point is that dharma only gets that particular thing. Right? So then what does that get for you? What does it get for the soul? Nothing. That's why it says give up all dharmas and just surrender to Krishna. So then we're just performing devotional service to Krishna. And then these dharmas can be engaged in Krishna's service. But the dharma on its own doesn't have any meaning. You know, that was what Pallad Maharaj was talking about. The 10 dharmas, you know, these that are for gaining liberation. It means there's so many other dharmas for elevating yourself to the heavenly planets or, you know, different things like that. But he was just citing the 10 for liberation, because if you throw those out, you've thrown out anything lower. So that means there's all those dharmas that are there. And their only purpose is use in Krishna's service. But it's not the using them in Krishna's service, it's being engaged in Krishna's service that's important. Then, being engaged, you're using those. So, does that make sense? So that's what we're trying to come across, is that the soul is connected with these. So therefore, since we're dealing with the body, then we deal with these different religious elements, but only in connection with Krishna, because it's not the position of the soul actually to be connected with the body. But since it is, then we're engaging those. But the real point, the soul is connected with the Lord. That's the connection we make. Then these other connections, since the body's there, we engage it in its appropriate duties. Is that?
Yeah. But it's important to know what the dharmas are, then you know what we're engaged in. That's what, yeah.
It is, but only in as much as it is connected to Krishna. Like that. And what are our dharmas? The tendency is we know everybody else's dharma, but we don't know our dharma.
Our dharma is to point out the dharmas.
Oh, okay, yes. Yes, excuse me. I say? Due to, what would you say? An oversight here, we were, that it means here it's being brought up, that the modern dharma is to point out to everybody else what their dharma is. Because if everybody else does their dharma, you get benefit. But they won't get benefit unless you perform your dharma. But that's a minor point. You know, yes, that's their problem. Yes.
So basically, we see that yogis in samadhi and devotees on the level of bhav, they don't, because their consciousness is with Krishna or within themselves. They don't feel any mental or physical pain, but everybody else basically...
Yes, because there's some connection with it. To that degree that you are absorbed in Krishna, it bothers you less. It's not that it won't be felt, but it's how it will affect you. See, there's two things. One is whether you even notice it or not.
Yeah.
So that we mentioned basically, you know, for those who are embodied or, you know, or those who are not acting as paramahamsas or avadhuts, then... You know, that's not actually a possibility. So, therefore, but how do you perceive it? That's the whole thing. Just like Bali Maharaj, he lost everything, but how did he perceive it? He perceived it in relationship to the Lord. So he saw it was by the Lord's mercy. Now all my material attachments are removed, so now I can, you know, just all that's left is surrender. So, that's the other thing. So it may be just nice for the senses, disturbing for the senses, or like this, but how do you perceive it? That's the whole thing. You know, yeah.
So the perception is on the level of intelligence.
Perception is, no, in this case it's on the platform of chitta, the consciousness. Intelligence is controlling the senses so that you can actually tell the difference between things. Right, discriminate. That's the intelligence part in the senses. But the mind's part in the senses is collecting the information as manas, but then interpreting the information as chitta. So that's where the samskars are. So that's where you talk about you purify yourself, you change the samskars. So therefore, you purify how you interpret something. Does that make sense?
So the samskaras are in the intelligence?
No, they're in the mind. Like that. Because it's impressions. Intelligence just tells the difference between things or the commonality between things. That's all it does. But why you're doing that, that's because of intelligence. I mean, because of the mind.
The samskaras are not in the heart?
But everything's in the heart. Mind, intelligence, ego, the soul, super soul, polluted consciousness—it's all in, it's all in the heart. That's what we mean by chitta, like that. So if you're focused on the Lord, then that means then when it's impurified, then the mirror of the mind is clear, right? Then you can see the Lord clearly. Because if you can see yourself, you can see the Lord. But if it's polluted, then that's the impure consciousness. So that's what we call as mundane. Pure consciousness, that's the soul. Polluted consciousness, we'll say that's one of the 24 elements. Okay. Because the soul is within the body, because the soul within the body, we're not going to get through this. Down to the last sentence. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Jai Shri Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivinoda ki, Jai Nitai Gaura Premanandini.